Hey, everybody, and welcome to the NFL Roadshow, an episode that was going to be solely dedicated to the Bengals and their first trip to the Super Bowl in three plus decades, how they got there here, what we should expect, what it means for Cincinnati. And we are still going to get to all of that, but we're going to put that episode out on Friday with former Bengals free safety Solomon Wilcots. The truth is, a lot happened this week that we were not expecting, and I feel like we need to touch on some of those things today. And very on brand for me, that will not include a long conversation about Tom Brady's retirement and what it means for the rest of the league, because while I think it's huge and it did catch me off guard originally when it was first reported last week, and I do have thoughts, I trust that you have consumed enough content about that elsewhere. And I know that some of you may feel that way about the topics that I do want to address today, but I'm going to ask you to hear me out because I think that there are important conversations that need to be had. And I'm hoping that the ones we're going to have on this show are different than the ones that are taking place elsewhere. I want to talk about Brian Flores's allegations of racial injustices in the NFL's hiring practices, of pressure to break the NFL's rules by tampering. He even alleges that the owner of his former team, Stephen Ross, set up a meeting with a quarterback from another team without his knowledge, a meeting that he refused to attend. He alleges that Ross offered to pay him extra for losses in order to tank and get the best draft pick. Allegations that Hugh Jackson has since jumped on with and said the same thing happened to him in Cleveland. And of course, all of this has shaken up the NFL landscape in dramatic ways this week, and so has the NFL's response to it. Officially, that response has included a statement issued 2 hours after the lawsuit was filed, saying both that they were deeply committed to ensuring equitable employment practices, but that these claims were, quote, without merit. 2 hours after the claims came to light, they decided they were without merit. And we'll talk to Steve Weitsch from NFL Media about that in just a bit. First, though, the response made me think of the league's handling of the investigation into the workplace culture of the team in Washington. An investigation and response that also felt a little dismissive. So much so that there is going to be a congressional roundtable on Thursday to look into that situation a little bit further. And we will all be able to watch, and I'll have information on how to watch in just a bit. Chances are it will be harder to watch than the team's rebranding event that was held on Wednesday with lots of television coverage and fanfare. They are now the Commanders, if you didn't hear. Nothing Hogs related, despite the fact that they held the event on Groundhog's Day. More interesting to me was the fact that they held it on National Girls and Women in Sports Day. On the eve of this event in Congress, where former employees, mostly female, will be coming forward and reliving stories about how it wasn't a great place for women in sports to work. Stories they first told the Washington Post 2 summers ago, stories that resulted in an NFL investigation by a DC-based attorney, Beth Wilkinson, an investigation that has not been made public, save for a 2-paragraph summary of findings that suggests essentially the employees that came forward were onto something, and the culture wasn't great. No specific findings were disclosed. And the punishment that was doled out was a $10 million fine and a temporary break from participation for owner Dan Snyder, who turned control over to his wife, Tanya. As you've no doubt heard since then, the employees involved did not feel like that was enough, did not feel heard, and so here we are with a date in Congress at which 6 former employees are set to speak. And for more on what they will likely say and hope to accomplish, their attorney, one of their attorneys, Lisa Banks, joins us now. Let's break the huddle.
Hurry up, let's go!
2-1, 2-1, 2. Ready? Three.
Lisa, what exactly is happening tomorrow?
Well, the House Oversight and Reform Committee is holding a roundtable, which is sort of like an informal hearing. to do some investigation and ask some of my clients questions about the culture of harassment that existed at the Washington football team for over 20 years.
Okay. Haven't the people of this committee already heard the stories that are going to be told tomorrow? Those stories have been made available to them already, right?
Yeah, I think they've heard most of the stories. They may hear some new things, but they've heard most of what my clients have to say, although that was reported in the Washington Post. They have an opportunity to ask follow-up questions. They have an opportunity to dig deeper and to let my clients speak more freely about what happened to them and how they feel about it and what they think should happen.
And then what is the goal in a perfect world at the end of tomorrow? What would happen?
Well, in a perfect world, the committee is committed to moving forward and seeking more answers from people like Roger Goodell, Beth Wilkinson, Dan Snyder. And effectively, what my clients really have wanted from the beginning is accountability. And their position is, and my position is, you can't have accountability if there's no transparency. So until you know what happened and who was responsible, there's no way you can have true accountability.
Haven't the people of this committee already called for the NFL to release the documents that are related to this investigation?
They have asked for some of the documents. They've asked for emails, I think. They would love it if Roger Goodell or Dan Snyder would just simply turn over Beth Wilkinson's findings or any report that she had done. But they've made it clear they're not going to do that, and they haven't provided them to Congress either.
Roger Goodell said back in October that he didn't want to release their findings because he wants to protect the anonymity of the women who asked for anonymity. What is your response to that?
I just think that's an incredibly disingenuous and cowardly response by Roger Goodell. And he knows it's not true. My clients all participated in this investigation, some of whom wanted confidentiality, some of whom didn't. But as with any sexual harassment investigation, you can put out a report and protect people's confidentiality if they want it. You can redact names, you can omit names, you can anonymize the report in other ways. It happens every day. That's how it's done. And so, you know, he tried to use my clients to say that he cared about this issue. And he called them brave and used them to make it seem as though he cared. And then he blamed them for not being transparent and not releasing the findings when that wasn't what they asked for at all. They all wanted a report.
What would the next step when you say that the committee could move forward, you know, with this and try and apply some pressure to achieve that transparency? What would that next step look like? Would that be a public hearing?
I think they should continue the process. Maybe there is a formal hearing and certainly public hearing that would involve some of the people who made the decision, Roger Goodell, who made the decision to cover up the investigation. Maybe Beth Wilkinson, somebody who actually knows what happened and who's responsible, so that we can know whether there actually was true accountability here, which, you know, based on my knowledge sitting here today, there was not.
You believe that there has been a cover-up?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, there was a 10-month-long investigation, and it resulted in nothing. You know, they did an investigation about the pressure of footballs used by Tom Brady, and there was a 200-and-something-page report that was made public. This is the sexual harassment and abuse of women over the course of 20 years, and they got nothing. No report, no findings, nothing.
There were some punishments handed out to Daniel Snyder and the organization in the form of fines and his inability to be involved with the organization for a period of time. Is it your opinion that the punishment was not enough?
Yes, that is my opinion. So, I mean, listen, we're talking about multi-billion dollar organization, a billionaire who runs it. He was fined $10 million. Actually, the team was fined $10 million. He wasn't even fined. $5 million of which is for charitable contributions, which he would have done anyway and is tax deductible. So in effect, a $5 million fine. which is nothing. It's like pocket change. And putting his wife in charge of day-to-day operations for an unspecified period of time is sort of a joke. I think everybody can agree on that. So we don't feel like there's been any true accountability. And, you know, if people think there has been, it's hard to say that because you don't know what that report shows. I represent over 40 people. So I know what those people shared with the investigator. And just based on my knowledge, it is my considered opinion that there has not been accountability. And I don't know, you know, the half of what's in her findings. And I think it's far worse than even I know.
We'll be able to follow along with the roundtable that will be taking place tomorrow, right? So in some ways, it will be akin to a public hearing, not officially a public hearing, but the stories will be heard.
It's a hearing in that it will be accessible to the public. The members will be there. They'll be asking questions. The witness will answer. The witnesses will answer. They'll have opening statements. I don't think it's part of the congressional record. There are technical reasons why it's called a roundtable and not a hearing, but it will be, to the layperson, it'll be a hearing. You know, I think it is, like you said, akin to a hearing. So,
what are some of the things that people who aren't as familiar with some of the stories that we'll hear tomorrow, what are some of the things that we're going to hear that you are aware that you think people don't fully understand?
Well, you know, people need to understand that this culture of harassment and abuse existed for 20 years. It coincided with the ownership of Daniel Snyder. And the culture started at the top. I mean, it went from top to bottom. Dan Snyder has been accused of, as part of this, of objectification, harassment, and even assault. Those have been allegations that have been made against him personally as part of this investigation. And then it goes down the chain of command through his top executives. So it really is something that is not an environment which he oversaw and was an absentee owner and didn't realize this was going on. It really does land at his doorstep. And so this really is about accountability for him. And so you're going to hear from some of my clients tomorrow who are going to talk about the harassment they endured. They're going to talk about the culture that existed in the organization. Some will talk about Dan Snyder's participation in that culture. They'll also talk about how the NFL led them astray, lied to them, dropped the ball on this issue, and covered up the investigation. You know, all of my clients participated in the NFL investigation with the idea that at the end of it, there would be some measure of accountability and that there would be a report and that they would understand better what had happened and who was being held responsible. And to a person, they will say that Roger Goodell and the NFL let them down.
Do you have an opinion about why it is that the NFL has not released that report?
You know, I can only speculate. I think what's in that report, and I do think there is a report. I think what's in that report is incredibly damning for that organization and its owner. And Roger Goodell, for whatever reason, made the decision it was best not to have that become public. He effectively chose to protect Dan Snyder and not the hundreds of women who came forward.
The lawsuit that John Gruden has filed against the NFL, is there hope that that will help you? That some of the emails and information will be forced to the forefront in discovery?
Yeah, I mean, it would be great if that lawsuit resulted in all sorts of discovery and, you know, the Beth Wilkinson's findings and the documents and the report maybe could all come out in discovery. I've been involved in enough litigation to know it's just not that easy. And I'm sure that the NFL and others will fight that tooth and nail in terms of allowing that sort of information to come out. So if we do see any of it, it'll probably be years down the road. So I'm not holding my breath that is the answer to this issue.
what do you see as the most likely, like what's a better path? What do you think is the path that will ultimately lead toward the information coming to the forefront? What's the more likely version look like?
Yeah, I think this congressional roundtable is the first step, hopefully, in many that Congress will take to try to pursue accountability here and transparency. And so I do think that this is the best avenue because Congress has some power and Congress has some leverage here to force some information to come to light. And I'm hoping that this process provides my clients with some sort of justice. And I think this is the way we can get it. And if there is transparency and if the report or the findings become public, then I think the court of public opinion will lead naturally to the right amount of accountability. So, I think we are in a good spot right now. I think where we want to be. And I think Congress, if it does what it says it's going to do, I think we'll be in pretty good shape.
How important is that outside pressure being applied in this situation in terms of reaching that end goal? Because people tend to get upset and then get distracted. And right. I think there are a lot of people that think that that's what the NFL is kind of banking on happening here.
Oh, I'm sure they are, right? And I think they thought that this all had gone away until the Gruden emails leaked. And all of a sudden, people started asking questions again, like, hey, what happened to that information? And Congress got involved, and now we're all looking at it again. I think that if the findings are made public, I think they will be explosive enough that it's certainly going to capture the public's attention. And I think in this Me Too era, when you see those kinds of allegations, those kinds of findings, that kind of misconduct, I don't actually think it goes away that quickly when you have the actual facts in front of you. So I do think that the court of public opinion will be able to affect some real change here if and when we're able to see the findings.
You say that you're looking for justice for the women who have come forward. What does that justice look like?
Accountability. And, you know, one of the things that Roger Goodell has said is that there has been accountability and that the fine and putting Tanya Snyder in charge is appropriate accountability. But it's not really for him to say, right? There are hundreds of victims who have lived with this harassment and abuse for decades. And they need to say, yes, there's been appropriate accountability. And you can't say that if you don't know exactly what happened and who's responsible. So once they release the report and once we can all look at it, then maybe we will say, sure, the $10 million fine and Tanya Snyder leading the organization is true accountability, but I doubt it.
It depends on what's in the report.
It depends on what's in the report. We can't know whether we're seeing accountability until there's transparency into what happened and who's responsible.
Based on your conversations that you've had with the women who will be testifying, I don't know if legally that's the correct term, but will be speaking at the roundtable tomorrow. Is there something specific that they're looking for with regard to accountability?
Well, I mean, I think my clients believe, because they were there, that the culture that was created at the Washington football team came from the top, that Dan Snyder created and maintained and participated in this culture. And I think many people believe that that culture will never actually change and things will never actually improve until he no longer runs the organization.
Is there accountability within outside of Washington that in terms of the NFL at this point? You've said that you think that they've covered up the results of the investigation. So does this accountability ultimately land on their doorstep too?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think Roger Goodell has to be hauled before Congress and answer the questions about why did you sweep this under the rug? Why did you conduct and oversee a 10-month-long investigation, only to stick the report in a drawer. That question has to be answered, and it can't be answered by saying because the women wanted it, because they didn't.
Last question, because these are actual, like we're talking about this in like legal terms and being careful. And I know I want to be careful to talk about the fact that these are women and their experiences who are real women who have families, who have other things going on in their lives. And I would imagine that the last couple of years has been very interesting for them based on what you have witnessed for them. What has it been like? What have they gone through in your presence?
You know, it's been incredibly difficult for them over the last couple of years because they spent whatever time they spent working for the football team with nowhere to go to report harassment or abuse. And then they come out of that, however damaged they may be, and they think, here's a chance that somebody will listen. Here's a chance that there'll be some accountability, right? That somebody will be held responsible. And so they come forward bravely and they talk to the Washington Post or they talk to Beth Wilkinson and her team because the NFL tells them, we care. We want to do the right thing here. We want to get to the bottom of this. So they tell their really painful stories over and over again. And just like what happened to them at the team, nothing happens. And so it's been extraordinarily painful for them. And it's made them angry. It's made them really angry, which is why, you know, we're going to have six of them sitting at a roundtable tomorrow, talking very clearly and pointedly about how they were let down and how much this impacted their lives. But, they're really great, brave people who I give a lot of credit to because they've really put themselves out there. And in going to battle on this, they had to relive some really painful moments. So I'm really proud of them.
And just to be clear, they're not looking for money at the end of this.
No, it's not about money at all. It's just about shining a light on this kind of misconduct because in this day and age, it shouldn't be allowed to happen. And if it does, someone needs to be held accountable.
Lisa Banks, I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
If you want to watch the roundtable, it will be streamed live on Thursday, February 3rd at 10 a.m. Eastern. And you can find the link to watch it at oversight.house.gov or on the Twitter handle of the committee, which is Oversight Dems, D-E-M-S. Busy week for the NFL in Congress as a representative from Illinois also called for a different subcommittee to hold a hearing on racism in the NFL on Wednesday. He called for it on Wednesday. It won't happen. It didn't happen Wednesday, obviously. And that, of course, was in light of the lawsuit filed by former Dolphins head coach Brian Flores on Tuesday. When we come back, an exhausted Steve Weich from NFL Media will join us to peel back the layers on that story.
Hi, everyone. I'm Hall of Fame sportscaster Leslie Visser, and I've got a new podcast, In Conversation, where I'll draw from 45 years of covering the Final Four, the NBA Finals, Wimbledon, the World Series, the Super Bowl, the Olympics. CBS even sent me to the fall of the Berlin Wall. I think you'll enjoy the give and take, so subscribe today wherever you stream your podcasts or listen on the SXM app included in most subscriptions.
Steve, when did you find out about the lawsuit?
Well, I actually found out about it Monday afternoon. Remember it was a big celebration. Tom Brady's was a Monday or Tuesday. Tuesday when Tom Brady's retirement, we're still talking about it. And then bang, you know, I'm looking on Twitter and I'm seeing all this. I'm like, is this real? And then I'm seeing like, oh yeah, no, this is real. These were filed. And it was like, you know, Brian Flores is really stepping out because we know, this probably means it for him in coaching in the NFL. But the fact that he's decided to challenge a system that has been rigged and the NFL has known about for decades was an incredibly bold step.
So lots to unpack about what you just said there right out of the gate. First things first, the reason I asked is because sometimes you kind of get a heads up that like something's coming down the pike. That did not happen. You found out real time with everybody else. This lawsuit is happening and now we're reacting to it. Do you have a relationship with Brian Flores? Have you had a chance to reach out and talk to him at all?
No, I do not have that close of a relationship. We would see each other in person. We'd have conversations, but those were, you know, pretty infrequent. I'd see him two or three times a year, but we'd sit up and chat. I mean, we have, you know, he knows what I do. He knows what I'm about. I know who he is. I know what he's about. So, but I have not heard from him, have not reached out to him, you know, just watched him on the news cycle this morning.
Based on what you do know in those interactions, can you paint a picture of him for me? Because I think that that's interesting and part of the story here, because the people who are not open to hearing what he wants to say, some of the feedback that I've already heard from people is like, maybe he's not a people person. Maybe there were reasons that he was fired. Maybe, you know, all of this is symptomatic of something different. What is he like, in your opinion?
Look, I mean, look, in our conversations, he's very personable. You know, but in talking to people with the team and other people who worked with him and seeing how he kind of churns through coaches on the staff, he's not easy, right? You know, but a lot of coaches aren't easy. A lot of coaches are showing more patience, especially when they've won, right? Back-to-back winning seasons in Miami, the dude should have got a 10-year extension based on what their history's been, you know, over the past couple of decades. But, you know, again, some of the things you heard about, you know, just the way, you know, his staff, it's tough for him to keep coaches around, for him to attract coaches because, you know, some people said he majors in the minor and things like that. But at the same time, he won football games, right? He got these guys to play for him and to win games in tough situations. But it was just whatever it was in the building, they felt he was the guy who had to go. Again, a lot of other coaches have been showing more patience when you hear some of those things about them. But for whatever reason, they decided to get rid of Brian Flores.
Well, and I can't help but think too, sometimes circumstances make you a certain way. You have less tolerance for certain things. Maybe if you feel like the circumstances have dictated that your personality needs to come to the surface like that. And some of the things that he's alleged in this lawsuit kind of paint that type of a picture for me. It alleges a number of things, covers a ton of ground here. So there are allegations of tanking or specifically incentivizing losses. There are allegations of attempts to tamper. There are allegations of inequitable hiring practices and sham interviews to meet Rooney Rule obligations. So let's start there. What in his allegations with regard to that stood out to you?
That they're 100% true. And there's nothing the NFL has shown to dispute that. They recently enhanced the Rooney Rule, Lindsay, to say you had to interview for head coaching jobs two diverse candidates from outside of your building. Because what teams would do, as the Raiders did before they hired John Gruden, is they would find a Black position coach, run him through an hour, 2 hour cursory interview, humor him, so to speak, and then move on and hire the guy they wanted. So now what they've done is they're, you know, the league was like, okay, we know what you're doing. We see the sham interviews. Lindsay, I have talked to assistant coaches for decades who go into interviews saying, I know they're going to hire this guy, but my agent told me to take the interview so I can get the experience. So the next time I get the opportunity, I'll be a little bit more fine-tuned. I heard it from some candidates who've recently been through the coaching cycle this past weekend. I knew halfway through the interview I wasn't getting the job. I heard they liked this guy anyway, but halfway through the interview, I really knew that I wasn't getting the job. But they did it. So the sham interview is in full swing. The league knows it. Teams know it, which is why him putting this in this lawsuit, I mean, how are you going to dispute that? That's why when the NFL came out with a letter saying his case is without merit. Oh, no, it's not. Not on that count, right? The other things need to be investigated, but not on that count. And this is where I am hoping that maybe some former GMs or other people who have been part of the interview processes interviewing the candidate, not on the candidate side, come out and say, oh, yeah, we knew back in 2016 we were going to hire that guy. But we put a couple people through the processes because that's what we had to do. We knew we weren't going to hire them. you know, maybe we'd eventually hire him as a DC.
How do we fix that? Like, what's the next step there? Because that is them checking the box of the Rooney Rule. So it's not the spirit of the Rooney Rule, but it is technically complying to the Rooney Rule. If they want to hire somebody else, like, how do you fix this problem? Because the Rooney Rule's attempts to do that feel like they've clearly left some gray area here that are problematic.
They just left the loopholes for still the owners to exploit. Right. And look, the owners or the search firms that they hire, which rarely have a person of color among them, you know, so they're bringing in folks that they're comfortable with, right? Folks that they may know from here or there, or who look like them, or maybe in the same fraternity, whatever. Okay. So that's part of it. So, you know, Ron Rivera talked about it today, and my colleague, who you know well, Jim Trotter, has said this for years. Start the process off with blind resumes, right? Let's say you put up Eric Bieniemy's or Todd Bowles' blind resume against Kellen Moore's. Just blind resume. You don't know who they are, where they've coached, but let's just stack this up on experience, leadership, merit. Don't know who they are. Tell the teams to start from that point.
But the owners know who everyone is. They've decided based on what they already know. Like, they're going and getting, you know, Brian Daboll as an example in this hiring cycle. They're going and getting him because of what he's done with Buffalo.
I disagree. Let's look at Joe Judge. Do you think John Mara and Steve Tisch were like, wow, that special teams coordinator is that dude?
Yeah.
No. He took phone calls from Bill Belichick and other people saying, why don't you check out this guy? He's a really good organizer. He's a really good leader. And they made the freaking hire. Mm-hmm. And it turned out to be a disaster. Notice that the teams in this year's coaching cycle are pretty much the same teams that are always in the coaching cycle. Okay, let's take out the Vikings. Let's take out the Saints, right? The Dolphins are always, it seems to be, in a coaching cycle. The Giants are in this coaching cycle. The Houston Texans are in this coaching cycle. I wonder what they're doing wrong. It's not necessarily the best candidate that they're hiring, but they're taking people's word for it. And I, you know, again, put those blind resumes up. They don't know. These guys are going more so by hearsay and word of mouth than oftentimes track record and experience.
But then there's going to be an interview. And I think something that you said is ultimately the hardest thing to get around. And that is what they're comfortable with. Yep. Right.
Yep. I mean, look, how can you, Eric Bieniemy? I mean, Andy Reid, who's going to be in the Hall of Fame as a head coach, has pounded the table for him. How do you not take his recommendation, especially when you took it for a guy like Matt Nagy or a guy like Doug Peterson? You took it then. You know, look, someone like me, all I can say is the only difference, they weren't play callers. You know, they both, you know, my only thing is that Eric Bieniemy's black.
Like, I haven't heard any rumors even about what it is about Bieniemy.
Some people say, oh, he interviews poorly, but it's so subjective because the same people who tell you he interviews poorly, other people say, well, he interviews well. It's all about what you want. It is all about what you're looking for. You have some people in the hiring process who's like, I want my fan base to look at our head coach and look at him as this guy. There's all kind of goalposts moving when it comes to certain candidates. Prime example, about 4 or 5 years ago, I'm not going to name the team, but I got a phone call right after an interview. Said, oh my gosh, Terrell Austin, who at the time, he was a defensive coordinator in Detroit. I think I forget where he was. Terrell, he's like, oh my God, best interview I've ever done. This guy was absolutely incredible. And we're not going to hire him because they already knew who they were going to hire. Terrell Austin's a black guy. He's hopefully going to get promoted to defensive coordinator for the Steelers. But ever since that cycle of interviews, and for years, Leslie Frazier, great interview. This guy, great interview. So that's why I'm like, I don't want to hear this bad interview, good interview crap, because it hasn't worked either way. The goalpost moving is absolutely insane. Now it is, if you come from the Shanahan McVay coaching tree. And look, those guys, nothing against those guys. It's worked. Zach Taylor's in the Super Bowl against Sean McVay, you know, former protege, right? But when they're trying to make these decisions, who are they listening to? You know, we look at the Raiders, and I don't blame them at all for hiring Josh McDaniels. I think Josh is going to do a good job right there. But it wasn't like a widespread let's do a lot of digging here. But Josh, if you put his resume up in a blind interview, it's going to look damn good. Right. So that's where you have to just say, let's do this. But I just don't know. These owners who continue to be the teams hiring coaches every 3 or 4 years keep doing the same stuff. And it's the owners, Lindsay. It's the owners. It is the owners. It is not 345 Park Avenue League as a whole. It's the owners.
And that's an interesting point, because the owners, that's the hardest thing to control. It is their team. It is their business. It is their league. Like, there is no governing body that ultimately can say, hey, individual owner, you might have an issue here or a blind spot that you're not willing to recognize. And to me, this is ultimately, I deal with this with issues with regards to women in the business. You know, like, there are things that I know based on my experiences that I think are more directly linked to blind spots that people, and the problem is when people get defensive about the blind spots, you know, like, we all have blind spots.
Right. But the, you know, look, people aren't necessarily racist or sexist or homophobic, yep. but it is those blind spots
yep.
that you're talking about that I think are probably the bigger issue when it comes to hiring in all of corporate America. Look, we see it at the NFL Network. You know, they address it. They have summits and all these freaking programs and you know, affinity groups all the time. But when it comes to people calling shots, you can talk about it, but the blind spots or pigeonholing people or whatever, that's corporate America. It is corporate America all day. Prime example, whenever it comes to these diversity coaching hire issues, hey, let's call Steve Weich. Let's call Steve Weich. Hey, let's call Steve Weich. I am their guy. There are plenty of people who can talk about it.
Yes.
But, oh, hey, Steve's got a strong opinion like nobody else does.
Well, let me, because I called you. And one of the reasons, I even talked to my producer about this. I was like, I don't want to like put an ask out to like, you know, hey, Black journalist friend. But then there is also an element of, I don't want to have this conversation with a couple of white people. You know what I mean? Like, right. There is a perspective that I do want brought to the table and represented well. Do you know what I mean? And I think that that's a tough position that everybody's in with regards to this.
It's a tough position, but it's one we've really got to push the envelope on, because, and Jim Trotter, my colleague, and I are constantly saying this, tweeting this, whatever. Journalist, stop asking the Black coach who doesn't get hired what the problem is, and ask the white GM and the white team president and the white team owner what the problem is.
Yes.
You know, it's like, why is that so freaking hard? And it never happens. We default back to the blind spot. Mm-hmm. And that's where we've really, you know, people like you and me and others have got to push the younger people coming up behind us to be better thinkers and more out of the box thinkers, and not just fall into the set way that things are always done.
Yeah. Elephant in the room is that you work for NFL Media, and it's a tricky, you know, line to walk right now, because you are employed by those same owners that we're talking about having potential blind spots. How do you navigate that on a story like this?
I'm fearless. I'm fearless. Like, okay, if you want to take action against me, who looks worse? If you want to sit me down, or if you want to fire me, why? Why? I am not saying anything offensive. I am not talking about you personally. I am talking about hiring practices that have existed forever. There's nothing that I am saying. Yeah, it may be uncomfortable, but there's nothing I'm saying that's a personal attack or whatever. So if you are just hiring or trying to discipline me for just basically saying what everyone else sees, but I'm just saying it, who looks worse there? I'm comfortable sleeping, but I had to go through, after all the Colin Kaepernick stuff, inside and outside of the building, and breaking that story and having conversations about it, I'm very comfortable in my own skin, who I am as a human being, who I am as a Black person, and who I am as someone in this business that a lot of people look up to, who I hope have the backbone to speak up and to hold people accountable and to be watchdogs in an era where so many people are trying to come up to get Instagram likes. And that's why I think I'm going to continue doing what I'm doing.
So that brings up one of my thoughts about Brian Flores and the conversation surrounding him sacrificing his career by doing this. To me, I wonder if he thought that he didn't do that already by being non-compliant with some of his other allegations. Because when you are constantly the person who pushes back way down the road, when it's not specifically about that one thing, you know, sometimes people don't like people who are constantly pushing back, right? Like sometimes I've felt this when I have, as a female, said like, no, I don't want to do it that way. No, that is not how I want to represent myself. And then you kind of feel like you start to get a reputation, right? Like she's difficult or he's difficult or something like that. And I wondered if maybe Brian Flores didn't feel like he'd already sacrificed his coaching career when he wouldn't do the things that Stephen Ross asked him to do that he felt like compromised something in himself, because these 31 owners talk to each other. Do you think that the reasons, if the allegations that he said about Stephen Ross were true and that he was treated differently and ostracized after he would not tamper with another quarterback and throw games and all the things that he alleges, do you think that he would have even had a shot to be a coach in the league after that, based on what we know?
He didn't disclose any of this until after he'd gone through the interview process. So he must have known, okay, why does this guy get the job when he doesn't have my credentials? Why did this guy get the job when I interviewed there and he doesn't have my credentials? Oh, so all these other cats who I've heard talking about this for decades, it's happening to me now. Mm-hmm. Okay, so got to remember, Brian Flores isn't some 65-year-old dude who's been in this game. He's young. He's got 35, 40 years of coaching left in him. So for him to take a step like this is unbelievably brave and noble. You know, at least, you know, when the stuff that's absolutely provable about the sham interviews and how these teams are going about their business. So he may have felt that, yeah, my reputation is tainted, that the Dolphins are smearing me, because, you know, the character assassination stuff is getting ready to become on full blast over the next couple of days. He's going to be put on nitro blast when it comes to that. That's just how, you know, the Goliath works when people try to kind of push
it's
up.
It's without merit, by the way, Steve.
Yeah.
His allegations. Okay.
Yeah, right. Okay. And, you know, and so it's going to be interesting. You know, I would love to one day, when this all calms down, the emotions kind of out of it, say, did you really think you were going to be done? Because he had to know that it was going to be done. Yeah. But you know what? You know, maybe his alma mater, Boston College, hires him. Maybe he gets hired by one of these historically black colleges and universities where there seems to be a huge renaissance because of Deion Sanders and Eddie George, and Hugh Jackson, and those guys going to HBCUs. Who knows? Maybe he becomes a corporate leader of some sort, because now he's going to be seen as someone who challenged the system, who did it publicly, and he sacrificed his coaching career in the process.
The sham interview stuff to me feels like that is bad PR, but hard to prove. It's hard to find a smoking gun there legally. I'm not a lawyer. I don't know. The other stuff feels like there might be like that was included, because that stuff is more problematic legally and more easy to prove, and not just the PR backlash. Like when you read the lawsuit, what jumped out at you as something that will be the most easily easy to prove and therefore the easiest path to effect change?
Well, I mean, I don't know if there's anything that's easy to prove. I mean, like you said, it's going to be hard to prove a racial component if a team brought seven guys through, right? And let's say two were black, five were white, hire a white coach. Well, okay. There's still four white guys who didn't get the job either, right? So there's that part is going to be
and
very, very.
Maybe the white guy was the best coach. It's hard to prove because it's so subjective anyway.
Correct. Now, you can say, and this is what has happened for years, it would be the same three black guys getting job interviews every year. You know, Eric Bieniemy's on the tour. You know, Todd Bowles is on the tour. Like every team's interviewing the same three dudes, which is why, another reason why they said, two people from outside of your building have to be interviewed. So you could at least expand your thought processes. And I will say this, this year you saw more people you didn't necessarily know of get interviews because, you know, it did seem a little bit more expansive. It did seem slower, which is what the NFL had hoped teams would do. And so there's that part of it. But in terms of proving, you know, that Stephen Ross offered him, you know, a payout, he's got to have some witnesses or some type of documentation that's legitimate, that you can possibly prove, you know, in terms of saying, I forget that he was supposed to, you know, tamper and come try to lure and recruit a quarterback under contract. If there are witnesses and things there, then that's where that testimony and discovery.
That quarterback was supposed to arrive at the meeting, right? And he just left before the quarterback. So one would assume that that quarterback would be able to confirm that there was something planned.
If he knew, but unless this is just an A and B conversation between Stephen Ross and Brian Flores to arrange this, which we know owners tend to have handlers who arrange things. Proving some of this is going to be difficult. The sham interview part, the league knows all about it. Again, they put rules in place because they know all about it. But proving in front of a jury, which I believe he has requested, proving that this was exclusively based on race could be very difficult.
I said it snarkily and you responded in kind. The fact that the NFL responded as quickly as they did and said that the lawsuit was without merit. How did that go over there?
I mean, come on, Lindsay, you know, we used to work together. I've done this a long time. When there were allegations of bullying in Miami with Richie Incognito and Jonathan Martin, they hired Robert Mueller outside counsel to investigate. When there were allegations of pay for play with New Orleans and the bounty gate, they did their own investigation to do this, even though we're never going to get answers because they've decided to put the emails in the ether. When there were allegations of sexual misconduct with the Washington football team, they did an investigation and, you know, came to whatever type of discipline they did with Dan Snyder and the organization. To come out right away and say this is without merit, and then in the same breath, you're going to say that diversity is a huge cause and a push, and we spend more time talking about it. I think the messaging should have been like, hey, we're going to, you know, this is important. Diversity is important to us. We're going to take our time and to see what actually is here. But to come on, push back and say, this is without merit. You know, look, maybe some of the specifics, like the Broncos coming out and saying, you know, Brian Flores accusing us, you know, having John Elway and Joe Ellis coming to an interview hungover, like that's blatantly false. Okay. That's something where some character and some other stuff are being accused of you know, being damaged. Okay. I can see that pushback, right? Or if it's pushback on Stephen Ross saying I'm tampering or paying, I can see that pushback. But to say that these sham interviews and the processes are without merit, come on, man. I mean, that's one where you just gotta, please. That is, they and the league and teams know better. They know better.
Are you optimistic that this leads to change?
No. Why? Why should I be? Why should I be? What has the NFL shown? And when I say the NFL, I am not talking about the league office. The league office has been incredibly proactive. Lindsay, I lead discussions in the off season with ownership and executives and potential minority candidates. That includes women, Latinos, Blacks, Southeastern Asians, whatever. I lead these discussions. So that is why I have such inside knowledge of what is going on here. Okay. And it still hasn't amounted to dookie emoji. And so that is why I'm sitting here right now like, what more can the league do other than to tell owners, hire people of color, or else we're just going to start docking you draft picks, or we're going to start docking you salary cap space? And that's not going to happen. That's not right. You know, you can't change somebody's heart and somebody's conscience if they don't want to. And so, again, I'm just not optimistic because every day these owners are telling on themselves. Every day. And, you know, look, sometimes they're making the right decisions. Sometimes they're not. But, You know, and look, I don't want to let head coaches off the hook. I do not want to let head coaches off the hook. You got to hire your staff. And if you're hiring your boys, which is happening, you're hiring your boys, you're putting them in positions to get recognized. You know, you see a whole lot of, you know, and broadcasters, people in the media calling games. How many times are we going to look at Kellen Moore? Yeah, but how many times are we not going to talk about their secondary coach, Joe Witt, who completely revised the aspect of their defense, a black, the aspect of their defense that was considered a weak point, and they lead the NFL in turnovers. We're not going to talk about him. We're going to talk about Kellen Moore. So we as media have got to stop that crap too and to start giving due respect to some of the people doing things that are making differences on a team.
More blind spots.
Yep.
Steve, you're the best. Thank you very much.
You got it, Swaggy.
Always unflinching, Steve Weich, and you can follow him on Twitter at Weich89. And we will, of course, continue this conversation as it develops, and we will get back to the Bengals tomorrow. Talked to Solomon Wilcots about the makeup of that team and why he knew this kind of run was possible. In the meantime, if you enjoyed this episode, we would really appreciate it if you would leave us a 5-star rating and also leave a review. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Pandora, or wherever you get your podcasts. The NFL Roadshow is also available on the SXM app, free for most subscribers. Just download it today and tap podcasts. For video clips of the show and more, follow me on Twitter, Lindsay_Rhodes. I'm also on Instagram at LindsayRhodesNFL. The NFL Roadshow is part of the SiriusXM Podcast Network. The executive producer is Andrew Emmer. And a special thanks to SiriusXM's Senior Vice President of Sports Programming and Podcasting, Steve Cohen.
SiriusXM Podcasts.